Hello and welcome to Talk Gnosis, the web's premier talk show about Gnosticism, the ancient Gnostics, mysticism, meditation, society, politics, consciousness, time and eternity, and whatever else we feel like talking about. My name's Deacon Jonathan Stewart, and joining us today is our guest, Matt Christman, from the Chapel Trap House and Time for My Stories and Kush Vlog and at Kush Bomb on Twitter and a whole bunch of other amazing things. Hello, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure. Matt, you're sort of part of an unofficial mini-series, bonus episodes that we're starting to do that I'm calling Life in the Black Iron Prison, where we're expanding out, speaking to just Gnostic practitioners and academics about Gnosticism, to talk to people from other spheres of life about Gnostic themes. Now, before we get into the Q&A, into the interview, unfortunately, the most powerful Archon, the one that has to be served, is the Master Mammon. We are brought to you by viewers like you. We are listener and viewer supported through patreon.com/Gnostic. I'll throw that up on the screen here. And you can subscribe for as little as $1 per piece of content per month. In exchange, you get early access to all of our shows and you help to spread the light of Gnosis. And we don't want to put anything behind a paywall. So if you want more, just message me and I'll try to give you more. Just tell me what you want people to sign up for our Patreon and I'll do it. If you're unable to donate financially, it can really help us out just by telling people about the show, putting it on your social media, liking, subscribing, you know the drill. You can also do one-time donations at paypal.com/Gnostic. And yeah, that is the commercial. Matt Christman, my first question is, why are you interested, what seems to be recently, in having conversations about spirituality? And the second part of that question, are you starting a cult or joining a cult?
I definitely am not joining one. Because I know that my understanding, my spiritual awakening, whatever you want to call it, is too specific to allow me to subsume it into anybody else's paradigm, anybody else's symbolic language. So I would have to be starting my own, but I also don't want to do that because it doesn't really seem like they tend to work out too well. What you end up having to do, I think, is in order to like communicate your understanding to one that could be like durably transmitted to a group that can, you know, organize around it, it's going to be a lie, like all languages, as Nietzsche pointed out. And that means that all of the activities that are going to wrap around that central spike are going to end up coming from fraudulence. And so the math doesn't work out. So no, there will be no cult. But I have been, yes, like starting to grapple with spirituality. Because the beginning of the pandemic saw me reach a point of like personal crisis that I was unable to use my conventional methods of escape, of ignoring, you know, the spiritual sort of void at the center of my life. Because I was getting older. Also, I was literally trapped in my own home.
Yeah.
And the political project that I had sort of put a lot of my own investment of ego and meaning into was also falling apart. So that's the classic cliche, almost midlife crisis moment. And instead of deciding to double down on all of the most superficial sort of distractions and indulgences, like, you know, I'm going to buy a boat or something, I looked inward because I felt something. Yeah. Because I had reached sort of the end point of being able to reason my way through life. Reason was having a diminishing returns and being able to provide me with any basis to find any reason for being, any reason to do anything. And so I just had a feeling, I had an emotion. And that emotion, fortunately for me, I was in a frame of mind where after I had the feeling, I had a vocabulary internally that allowed me to talk my way down from the feeling, still having an idea of what it is, so that it didn't become evanescent, it didn't fall away and become just like a weird thing that I couldn't really place or slot into the rest of my life, which I think is what happens in most, for most of us. We encounter these really powerful feelings that do speak to something more that transcends our understanding of the world, but because we don't have the vocabulary to make sense of it to ourselves, we can't really keep it. Yeah. And I felt like I was fortunate enough to be able to myself anyway, start putting words around this feeling that made sense to me. But since I was still isolated, you know, I needed to have a practice that allowed me to continue, you know, resuscitating that feeling and reaffirming it. And that's when I started doing the vlogs, which was an attempt to sort of talk out what I was thinking and try to explain to others in words what I was feeling and where I think that came from. And because I got a response, because people seemed to, there are enough people seem to be saying that they felt like I was getting at something that they had felt, that it felt like I was speaking to something that they had experienced. That made me, that kind of grounded me in a sense of reality, like that this was a real thing, that this is not me sort of delusionally trying to create a story around an experience. And ever since then, I've just been on this path of trying to find the most, you know, because this is sort of, I woke up to this life with these relationships and with this job, if you want to call it that, and this audience. And now I have been trying to integrate this feeling into this place in the world and to try to use the one to express the other and vice versa.
Matt, this sounds like I'm trying to be funny or facetious, but has anybody said to you, because you're talking about spirituality, hey, are you okay? Like, are you?
Oh yeah, for sure. And I, of course, have over the course of this period been like, am I okay? And I have absolutely seen ways that this whole experience could have been very bad for me. Like in the sense of me getting like wrapped up in a, because if you're using words to try to make sense of an experience, you're lying in a way. Like you're having to approximate, and every level of translation is a level of latency away from the actual feeling. And so that means that if you get caught at any one of those semantic levels and you fixate too much on reifying that, what is really just an attempt to explain something using metaphor. If you get too latched into the metaphor and fixating on making the metaphor real, then you are going to go away from sort of some of that feeling that really does ground you and that removes the terror, really does remove the terror of existence, the stuff that makes you, that makes it hard to live, that makes it hard to see what's in front of you. And you eventually end up losing that in the pursuit of reifying the metaphor, because the reality of life in America at this point is of isolation. And like those feelings are best maintained through connections to others, through communal experiences. And we don't really have a lot of those. And now specifically in COVID time, we literally are separated from each other. So it's a lot of time by ourselves. And the more time you're trying to think your way around these feelings, the more chance there is that you can kind of just hit the wrong note and end up going off into the wrong area. And what the vlogs have done for me is constantly ground me, because like one thing I would often say, especially in the early ones, when I was really sort of getting conceptual, is I would say, does that make sense? And I was sort of like, just beg the audience to give me some sort of feedback. And the fact that I would get a lot of people saying, yes, it does, you know, that was really reassuring. And the fact that like these aren't people who had any they didn't know me, and I mean, yes, they had parasocial relationship with me, they think I'm their friend in the way that like internet celebrities are to people, but they were under no real obligation in that moment to lie to me, you know? So the fact that I was getting, you know, private messages from people and the things they were saying, they all sounded like they were screwed on tight. And so just having people who seemed to be relatively well-adjusted saying, this makes sense, that helped. That was another thing that helped me sort of stay grounded and prevent, because what happens if you lose the connection to others, if you stop making sense to others, then you start doubting, at least I, because I am like a inveterate skeptic. Like I've realized that about myself, and it's something I'm having. And I mean, it's a process, you know, of overcoming that skepticism. And I think that I am doing that, but it still is so deeply like hardwired into my responses that if I am alone for too long, you know, and if I am too caught up in building an abstract model, I'll start to doubt myself. And once I start doubting myself, I can create just as convincing a negative structure that undermines everything and that says, actually, no, but what you felt is it's your body telling you you're gonna die, or it's a delusion or something. And it has been the ability to build some sort of, you know, makeshift online pseudo community that has done the work of grounding me. But then also, you know, finding people in my life. I've been very fortunate to find people in my life who have helped me make sense of my feelings and have, affirmed for me that I am in fact okay.
So you were literally just on a podcast, which we'll link up in the notes, talking about Gnosticism. Death is just around the corner. And you were talking about the need for a genuine Gnosticism. And you've also referenced the world's rulers and actually a few times as archons. Now, yeah. I know it's kind of in a joking way, but instead of, say, calling them ghouls or demons. Yeah. And you're also on another podcast, which we'll link up, talking about demiurgic consciousness. So, yeah. A two-part question. Is there something right now about the world that seems to particularly resonate with Gnosticism? And do you personally find the Gnostic mythos and the Gnostic impulse, you know, resonates with you in some way?
It does, and I think it's because, so the way I imagine it, like I'm not a scholar of this stuff by any means. I'm lightly read on most subjects. That the monastic impulse comes from believing the truth of Christianity and then finding yourself living in a world where living a Christian life is impossible.
Yeah.
And trying to make sense of how that could be. And I feel like now we have, of course, replaced, you know, the spiritual world with a totally secular one. And with a secular set of values and a sort of a secular eschatology around, depending on your, you know, political position and class, like around personal virtue or if you're super rich, literally physical immortality or whatever it might be, or like the sort of vulgar. Like materialist eternity of evangelical Protestantism. But however you slice it, the world that we live in now is one where it's impossible to be a human of any kind, let alone a Christian. It's impossible to feel, to have emotional connections because the market has fully stripped us of our capacity to act out of any motivation other than the most base short-sighted self-interest, which has stripped us in a real sense of our humanity and turned us into the ants on the column from The Once and Future King, where everything that is not forbidden is compulsory. And if you live in that world, you have that same instinct of, I'm a human being and this is an inhuman world. Well, how can that be? How can a world made up of people be constrained physically, like in the real material of its being, from actually acting as individual human beings? like from an emotional, from a connection to each other, but instead only through like these dead market relationships.
Yeah, that's it exactly. And you know, you may not be a scholar of Gnosticism, but I think you did really capture the essence of it. And just the struggle to be human, right? It sounds like a contradiction, but I would say the Gnostics argue to be fully human is to be fully divine.
Yes.
And we live in under a world system, and we numerous world systems throughout the history of humanity that strip us of our humanity, that stop us from being fully alive, from being fully human, from being fully connected to ourselves and to others. Matthew, what does love have to do with solidarity?
I think love is solidarity is the social expression of love. I think solidarity is the understanding, the recognition at an emotional, not intellectual level, of the fundamental connection between all human beings. And then solidarity is the attempted material expression of that. It is a practical frame of mind that directs your action, or should direct your action, that is motivated by a recognition of others, not a renunciation of others, which is what capitalism insists upon. The capitalist world, the demiurgical world we live in, insists that we are all separate from one another, that we are individual, that we are homo economicus, that we are all self-interested economic agents who have no connection to one another. And of course, that is not just wrong. It's literally, I think, by any means, any definition, it's a blasphemy, because the connection between all others is the sum total of like spirituality, of all religions. It's all an expression of connection, of unity. And so like capitalism is like the final heresy. It is an insistence that you are an individual. Like that, and Ayn Rand is sort of like is this the closest thing we have to like a antichrist of the modern world in terms of articulating intellectually a world that is the literal opposite of its existence. And that in a world that if we insist on acting as though it were real, we will destroy the world and each other, because we are literally operating in defiance of the fact of our connection. And solidarity is the social expression of love that denies that, that denies the false notion that we're separate from one another.
Well, that actually leads in quite well to my next question, talking about that false sense of being separate, the false sense of the individual. So there is a lot of discourse in, say, political circles about false consciousness and the simulacra, or the dream world of cyberspace. And of course, the Gnostics were very big on the illusory nature of this world and how humans are deceived both by internal forces and external forces. Matt, are we in a dream world? What's keeping us in this dream world, and how do we wake up?
We are in a dream world. We are in a false world, because I would say at base, because we're afraid of non-existence. Yeah. We're afraid of because we know we are finite, we know that we're mortal beings, but our minds are also the sum total of the universe, because we live these separate, segregated, fragmented, atomized lives, and with access to more information than anybody in history has had access to, which means we can realistically fantasize that our minds are some sort of version of the universe, and it is finite. So like we all live lives of apocalyptic dread, because like Ayn Rand said, when I die, I don't die, the world is gonna die. And that is how we all operate. That's what we operate from. And that's the fantasy, that's the illusion. The illusion is of a separate self that needs to be protected psychologically. Because all of the most the self-destructive things we do, the things we do to flee from one another, to flee from connection, and to flee from love, are in the pursuit of distraction, are in the pursuit of reifying our own, a fantasy of our own eternal existence. It can't last, but it doesn't have to. It only has to last long enough for us to get the next thing that keeps us on that track. But everything we do to build that separation, it reifies in the world a situation where humans are put against one another, are exploited on one group exploited on behalf of the other, and another group exploited and exploiting at the same time, and people living literal lives of separation from one another, where we interact with one another only through symbols. We never have in a given day a sum total of experiences that are present, that can have a presence that transcends our illusory egos. And so the world that we have, because we have technology at our fingertips to shape the world through our decisions, through our consumption decisions, we are making a fake world. We're making a world where things exist that have a permanence that is metaphysical in our minds, like private property, for example, that are not real at all, but that structure our day-to-day life, structure our emotional responses, structure our desires most of all, and that leave us unable to connect. And the only way that we can wake up is if we feel something. And the tragic, sad reality is that as capitalism accelerates, the opportunities to feel at all are reduced. Like, we have a person being born into, even into suburban comfort as it exists in America at this point, will have in their life far fewer opportunities to connect to other people, like to be in the same room with somebody, looking them in the eye, all that cliche stuff, than generations before did, even their parents did. And they will be spending more of their life than ever before in front of a screen with a simulated reality that is literally a simulation. Like, it's not even figurative. It is an actual expression of the simulation that we live in around us, because there are so few pleasures to be found in the actual world as we have created it, because of how socially impoverished we are. There is no amount of indulgence that most of us can access that can make up for the loneliness at the heart of modern life. That this internet exists as like this final frontier of fantasy within the fantasy, where we can escape to find some meaning and find some feeling. And we do find meaning and feeling, but they are this copy of a copy of a copy. They are a pale, pale, pale simulacrum. And worst of all, it's a sterile meaning. It cannot transcend the falseness of the simulated reality, because caring about it requires you to buy into the fantasy in the first place. So working within it cannot break you out of it. So it's a grim situation, but we break out of it because we still have human hearts. We still love. We still have a feeling that no matter what we try to, how we try to deform it and commodify it, it's always there. This love, a felt connection to the world around us and the people in it. And that means there's always, every day, a chance to have an experience. What experience that is, I can't say, because it's got to come from one's personal life. And it's going to involve like an intersection of past and present and emotion that is all fully embedded in that moment, like defined by the reality of the moment. But what I now know is that is there, that can happen, and it's always available. And if that's true, then as bad as it looks, and as broke and as entranced as we it is, it does seem like we really are within the demiurgical iron prison, the chance to transcend it exists for anyone. And if enough people are able to have those experiences and bring themselves together and cooperatively act where they are not building organizational structures that require like compulsory mechanisms to keep people on the same page, because everyone is actually operating out of this base self-interest, even if they think they're operating out of like some liberatory political agenda. If they're moving in the same direction because of their heart, not because of something that they've convinced themselves is like a utilitarian good, then the power that they have in acting is massively more powerful than the structures of compulsion that have been created, because they really only work on you if you let them. And at some point, we all have the power to just say no.
So I'd argue, and let me know if you agree or disagree, but I would argue that irony and sarcasm were originally a means of the critiques of our society, right? It's an almost Gnostic meta impulse that consciously or unconsciously was aimed at a kind of liberation, at least socially. And this was especially big for Gen X, but of course has, you know, rippled down to the generations after, as well as the entire world. Now, however, it seems that irony is now a trap. Like, what happened?
I do agree, yes. Irony is originally a way to get some sort of truth out of the big lie of the social order, because like all the culture that a exploitative world that is designed to reinforce difference, reinforce exploitation, its culture will take all that is bad and tell a story where it's actually good. Like that's what the super cultural superstructure is. It is a story to tell you, hey, you know all those bad feelings you have? Well, the things that's causing them are actually good, and the things that you're seeking are actually bad. And that whatever culture it is, whatever mode of production it is, that story is the story that you hear and that you experience through culture. And that means that like the emotions you're expected to feel are generated by that same upside down moral order. And so irony and sarcasm are essentially flipping back over the machinery to say that I'm being told that this is that up is down and down is up, and irony allows that to be flipped. I would say that where we have sort of lost ourselves in the wilderness, I certainly know that I have been lost there in the past, is that the new reality of online existence, of living a substantial portion of your actual time in your body looking at a screen, where the physical aspect of life, like the physical dimension of presence, of your presence in your body, the presence of other people who are near you in their bodies, all of those overpowering stimuli of just facial expression and vocal intonation and tactile connection that comes with being in a room or in a place with other people, being replaced by a situation where you are engaging with others in a fully disembodied way, and you're choosing who to interact with by a click of a mouse, meaning that you're not actually interacting with anybody. We are all talking to ourselves when we go onto like a social media platform or argue with somebody in a comment section or something. We are, because we are seeking out stimuli. We're seeking out people to get mad at, people to agree with. But we're seeking them out through our own desire or our own thought of what our desire is. So we're not actually encountering any of these other people. We're encountering these disembodied statements, and that we get to imagine a person behind. But that person, because we don't know them, we have no actual experience of them, we can mostly make up. So we're peopling a world and we with characters of our own invention. And so the culture that we're making there is not an attempt to, you know, reverse the lies of the order that we live in to pull back the curtain. It is fully accepting the parameters, fully accepting the structure of capitalism as eternal, the structure of our separateness from each another as eternal, our solipsism eternal, and then indulging in it. And so irony becomes essentially a form of masochism. Like, it's sadism to others, but because this is all made up, the pain that we imagine we're inflicting on them, it's all in our heads. So we're essentially doing it to ourselves. It's like being caught in a trap, an animal caught in a trap, just chewing on its own flesh.
Are there dangers around the language and the ideas of the real, and that's the real of a capital R, and the authentic self, capital A, capital S?
Obviously, it's all dangerous to talk about because you're talking about it, you know? Like, as soon as you're using words, you're out, you're lying, you know, in the Nietzschean sense. You're trying to approximate something. And everybody who hears you talk about it is bringing their own definition of those words to their translation of it, which are not going to be the same as yours. Even if it's word for word the same definition, it does not have the same individual emotional connections because you've had different experiences than them. And so these words get turned into fetishes, like authenticity, for example, which is like the prime maniacal urge of people online is seeking the authentic. That is a chimera. It cannot happen because it's a fallen decayed version of the concept. There is an authentic self, and there is a real, but they are inaccessible to language, and as such, it's very difficult to talk about them. But what you end up having to do is essentially talk around them. You have to, like, I'm getting in the process of trying to write something like that sort of breaks down my understanding of like the current political cultural crisis we're in and the individual implications of those for our souls and the challenge that we're faced with. And I'm realizing as I'm like figuring out what I want to say that there are concepts within this that I just cannot talk about. Not because I'm wrong or that I'm not confident that I could express myself to my own satisfaction, but because I know that the people who are going to encounter this are not going to have had my experiences and are not going to be able to take this language the same way it's intended. And so there is this Straussian process of sort of creating spaces for people to make inferences without alienating or putting people on the wrong track by being overly specific about things that are just too close to the bone of the transcendent.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and that's something for perhaps people like me and in my community where we are fairly non-dogmatic, but we are encouraging of people to be spiritual in a very literal way, to have spiritual experiences and not to be afraid of that. Right. But at the same time, not be dogmatic. But at the same time, why are we hanging out together? What is it that we're doing? So we have the shared symbol set, right? While recognizing that these shared symbols, that there's limits to them and there's a limit to sharing them. And I personally, I have a small community here in Montreal, and, you know, I do talk about spirituality, spiritual experiences, things that could and have happened, but I try not to talk about any personal spiritual experiences that I've had, partly for some of the reasons that you're talking about. And also because they're almost impossible to put into words. So
yeah, and that's why the key is, like you said, getting people together to have shared experiences so that the vocabulary that emerges from those experiences is inflected with a shared emotional response to those words, because you all know what you're talking about when you're talking about X or Y, because you were there together when it happened, when the feeling happened. And that's what the, like, I have been on my streams trying very hard to pull myself away from prescriptive speech, from prescribing people anything to any telling anything that they should care about, do, or anything specific. Because, I mean, it boils down to there's two things I can tell you to do. There's the things involving having opinions and emotions about events, what you should think or feel about X, Y, or Z. And I will maybe give you my idea of what I think is happening, but I will absolutely not tell you how to think about it in that case, because it doesn't matter. Because that is part of that entertainment simulacrum where this is just a thing for you to care about. This is a Chinese finger trap for you to put your head in while you're avoiding living, because it sucks too much to do that, to live. But then the other one is like, okay, well, what about what should I do in my life? And to that one, I say, that answer is not anything I can give you, and it's not anything anybody else can give you. You can find that answer, but only in your actual life, because you will not have some sort of aha, most likely not have some sort of aha rational thought where you've reasoned yourself to the right thing. You will feel something. And in that feeling, you will adhere that feeling to something close to you. And if you're paying attention, it'll be easy, because it'll be literally right in front of you. And then you can follow that feeling to another feeling. And then you have created a chain of emotion. And if you're connecting, and if you're having those feelings with other people, they're having that exact same experience, which means that you are growing these socially dense connections between people. And that is what we're not going to defeat capitalism or even save ourselves from annihilation by using the social vocabulary of self-interest to do so. Because our self-interest really, honestly, is in get what you can while you can, because it's all falling apart. Why are you trying to do anything other than care about yourself? Now, a lot of people, because they have values that are connected to like a genuine human desire to see things better, but that have been perverted by their loneliness more than anything into a pursuit of quixotic political projects, they decide, no, I'm going to try to save the world. And that is, but the thing is, that's still a selfish expression. It's still me. It's like, I've decided, no, I can't. I either can't, or I think it's wrong to pile up lucre. Instead, I'm going to try to save the world, but it's all on behalf of an ego. And that means that when social action is coordinated by those reasons, you get infighting, petty bickering, a fixation on minutia, and a paralysis, just like you do within a person. And for the exact same reasons. And that is why, historically, the working class, like in Marx, the working class is the class that's going to drive through this, because they all share a self-interest, which will then allow them to push through. Problem is now, in America, our combination of geography and empire have allowed us to essentially buy off that existential pain at its root by distributing people throughout the land, creating petty landowning, sort of petty bourgeois out of our white middle class or our white working class, ghettoizing our black working class and reinforcing social separations between them that make connection impossible, and literally scattering the white working class to the wind so that they're living separate lives in isolation, and then destroying the modes of production that allowed for close working conditions like big factories. So now people literally do not work in congregation. They do not have any shared understanding of self-interest. So even that is now out of the toolkit of the left, I think. The only thing that can motivate a bunch of disparate people with disparate narrow self-interests, it cannot be a machinery of compulsion, because it's going to have to be voluntary, because the money's not on our side. You can always walk away. This is all a thing within a thing that is totalizing and has disciplinary mechanisms and mechanisms of temptation that are going to pull you away from it. The only thing that's going to power it are dense social ties of love, of emotion, so that you can't operate against the best interest of the movement, because it would hurt you. It would feel like pain to you as much as it would feel is because you would feel the pain of others. And that's what's going to, I mean, the how successful it will be in, you know, preventing the fall of the House of Usher, I don't know. I think that it is possible, and therefore it has happened somewhere and will happen somewhere, and maybe it'll be here. But if whatever resistance to total atomization comes, it will be forged by those connections.
Yeah. A related question going back to the talking about irony and authenticity. Matt, how do we leave irony behind and go for sincerity and even go for cringe when genuineness and sensitivity, they've been made part of people's personal branding strategy? Like, I've seen a lot of toxicity, actually, I'll just say evil, coming from people whose public personality is built around being authentic and being sensitive.
Yes, absolutely. Well, honestly, I feel like that's one of the things that makes people really want to cling to their irony. It's because they see how many people use the smug virtuousness, who use the fact that they would never be ironic and never use a slur at being just the most petty, vindictive freaks, just awful people. And so it's essentially, it's a condition of the generalized mistrust of living online as we do, because we are all operating from self-interest, which means we have to assume that everyone we interact with is, and remember, because they're just a projection of us, they are. And so when we encounter anybody else online that we don't really have a friend relationship to, or like a durable, mutually beneficial relationship with, an outsider, a enemy in the Schmidtian sense, when we encounter them, we have to assume that they basically are all of the worst parts of us. Yeah. They're all the parts of us that we hate about ourselves, minus the self-exculpatory stuff. Because the thing that makes you not hate someone, even no matter what bad they do, is if you understand why they did it. Yeah. If you understand why somebody did something, or even you can feel like you can make sense of their actions from within them, you can't feel hatred for them, because they didn't do it on purpose. There is no evil intent there. There is only misfortune. There is the misfortune they've encountered that drove them in that direction. So that's why you can never really hate yourself, no matter how much self-loathing is the lingua franca of the internet. Really, everyone loves themselves. They love themselves too much. The demiurge is us. The demiurge is our egos. But we also lived our whole lives, and so we know why we are the way we are. So we accept it. Everybody else we encounter online is all the evil stuff that's in us, but without any explanation, without any exculpatory story. We can just instead fill that with the worst interpretation, so that we can hate them, so that we can have hatred for them. And that means that when you say stop using, you know, abusive irony, stop attacking, the response will be, well, okay, if I do, what about them? What are they going to do? I am at their mercy then. And I would say that online specifically, I mean, this goes into all levels of like activism, and it's one of the main things that makes it impossible to have intersectional politics in the way a lot of people think you can, because the intersection comes with inherent mistrust for the outgroup, assumption of self-interest of the outgroup, which means that we have to, like in a prisoner's dilemma, operate from self-interest of our group, which means we cannot negotiate like a collective agenda. We have to fight for primacy among all groups, because that's the only, because we can't trust that anybody else won't just screw us over if we act first in the best interest of all. They will fuck us over, and we rationally reject to do that. So that's a problem that exists all through all structures of activism and human relationship, and has to be worked through. Online, though, it really is a thing where you can cut the Gordian knot, because it's like, okay, fine, you put the weapons down. You stop having to build up this bile to justify being mean to people. and you get nothing for it. Nobody credits you, and they decide that they're going to use it to own you. So what? Okay, big deal. Like, your online persona is injured. Somebody has cringed at you. Does this matter in any sense? And if the answer is it does, well, then you have work to do. You have work to do detaching yourself from that emotional relationship, because it is voluntary. And like I said, like, the hope of the world is that we can all change, because it is a self-conscious act. It is what, like, we have free will, because although it feels like we're on rails and there is like a physical determination for all actions, we also have the ability to think ahead of our brains, basically, because of the thought occurs in a quantum space. Thought occurs beyond cause and effect. Like, that's a fact. Like, mental processes begin at a level of size where we know by observation conventional cause and effect breakdown. And that means that actions taken at that point can move ahead of the fucking billiard ball. But for most of us, we are so programmed by our experiences and by a world that beats us and traumatizes us into a deformed relationship with the world and a perceived separateness that we need to protect, and that powers of terror that powers us forward along these, like, on these guidelines. If we can take time and not allow those emotional reactions to shape our actions, we can, like, take that quantum time within us and move out of love instead. And once you do that, you have literally jumped rails into a different reality. Like, you're in the same physical world, the stuff's still there, but there is now another dimension to experience. There is an emotional, like a hum, I guess I would say. Like, that isolated feeling that I know I grew into is like a hyper-alienated, hyper-intellectualized late 20th century American, a Nietzschean last man. I know that the world felt different, felt emotionally different at a moment-by-moment basis than it does now to me for the majority of my life. Like, there was an empty room was quiet in a – the reason – and I think this is the reason people can't have quiet, why people have to have the TV on all the time, people have to have something in their ear. It's because they can't hear the silence, because the silence is separateness. The silence is death. The silence is you are one mind that is in a decaying flesh body. You're a universe that will end. But there is another world that is exactly like the world you live in, where that quiet is not empty, that there is a immanence within it. And that immanence is your connection to everything around you. The fact that this is not a bunch of stuff. It appears to you as a bunch of stuff, and you interact with it with a bunch of stuff. These aren't a bunch of other people. These are all parts of one universal being, an awareness and a body that you are a part of. And if that's true, and you can't think yourself to it, but you can feel it on a moment-by-moment basis. If that's true, then that can rob the every question that you have to answer yourself of every day about what you need to do. Like, which door to open? It can rob that door. It can rob that question of the compulsory machinery of, like, capitalist Skinner box Pavlovian compulsion, the enslavement of the demiurge. Yeah. If you're not afraid, because it's like, obviously, if you get really close to death, you'll still be afraid of death, just because for most of us, we haven't spent our life on a monastery, like, you know, attaining a sense of, you know, detachment from worldly needs. We have spent our lives attached to shit. So if it's coming at us, it's going to be very scary. But most of our decisions are not life and death decisions. But they are charged with this fear of losing out on pleasure, losing out on distraction from oblivion. If you're not worried about losing that, you can pick a door that's different. And you can be liberated, even if you still live within this machinery of capitalism. And even if you still have to, you know, render under Caesar, you are not doing so under the lash. You are doing so as a free person who is only able to operate that way because you're not afraid anymore. Because you know that, and not being afraid means you can understand and love everything because none of it is a threat to you.
Yeah, I think there's a reason why the phrase "be not afraid" pops up in the canonical Bible quite a bit.
Yeah,
some religions, Tibetan Buddhism, some forms of Gnosticism, even talk about warrior spirituality, which can sound kind of cheesy when you bring it up, but it's about bringing that kind of courage of not being afraid to go to those places. I also think too of some of the Gnostic mythos, where unlike in some other systems that view humanity as divine, or at least potentially divine, theosis, you have to become divine. You have to work really hard at it, and then you can be worthy of becoming divine. In Gnosticism, you're already divine, but you don't know it. And you can't know it by me telling it to you. You have to know it through going through this process, through the experiences that you're talking about.
Yes.
Matt, this is... okay, so a lot of people think I'm being prescriptive instead of descriptive when I talk about the bad things, in my opinion, that happened when religion was taken out of public life. Now, I know you're thinking, hey, I live in America. There still seems to be lots of religion here. But religious attendance is dropped across the board throughout most of the first world, the developed world, whatever you want to call it, right? Including the United States. A lot of people don't seem to realize the evangelicals are loud, but church attendance is dropping, okay? Like, we're living in secular societies. So I obviously don't want to go back to the bad old days of school prayer and, you know, that having the expectation of belonging to a specific sect. But at the same time, I think waking up one morning and removing religion, trying to remove religion 100% from a society has caused some bad things. So for example, like this is kind of hack, but it's kind of hack to point out that like QAnon or some expressions of Idpol or Stan culture or the Chapel subreddit are religions. that said, there's actually some fascinating work coming out from some sociologists of religion who are confused because we live in pretty stressful times, right, Matt? And they're confused about why aren't people joining more cults? Why isn't cult attendance going up? Because in other times, like the 1970s, in other times of great social and economic unrest, people go looking for answers, they join cults. So sociologists are like, why aren't people joining cults right now? The world's super messed up. And one of the theories, why not, is that the sort of person who would join a cult instead is becoming a Marvel movie fan, right? They're joining Stan culture. So all this said, do you think all these people in communities would just be happier and healthier if they just found Jesus?
You know what? I can't. This is the question. Like, how do you try to turn this into a politics? You know, and it's like, if everybody found Jesus, that could do the job. But the problem is, what does Jesus mean? You know, like, how do you turn that into a public symbol that has an agreed upon meaning? Because there are plenty of people in the exurban McMansion belts of this country who believe in their hearts in Jesus. They believe in Jesus deeply. Now, they actually believe literally in the devil. They're literal devil worshipers, which is pretty, it's a funny little twist. Like, I mean, I'm surprised nobody's ever done that. Like, they did Rosemary's Baby with like the Upper West Side rich people, but it really literally American Protestantism at this point, which is consumed American Christianity in general, really, is essentially Satan worship. And how the hell do you use the same words that mean to millions of people, and not just people who are evangelical Christian, but people who have encountered evangelical Christianity, to literally mean the devil? You know, and I don't know the answer to that. I certainly do think, though, that there has to be a reinvestment of some religious conceptions with meaning that cut through our culture war conceptions of religion, which they're really just armor for our combat with one another. Like, they're just the symbol we put on our shield as we go to fight for resources, which we're piling up for no fucking reason. Because we imagine that we're going to create heaven on earth in the form of a fucking Ten Commandments based water theme park. And That means that the spirituality, the public spirituality to come, and it will involve people who are currently of all number of faiths and who feel those faiths deeply and actually connect those symbols to love as it is and as it always will be, are going to come together. I don't know what it's going to look like, though. And that's another thing where I can't get too ahead of myself in terms of prescribing, because more than anything, I am someone who has lived my life to this point as one of the most isolated monads available. I am right up there with the hikikomori in terms of my disconnection from social existence for the vast majority of my life. And I'm only now even close to coming into contact with, like, with other people at a social level where I'm interacting with people not out of a desire to be distracted or to have my ego reinforced, but out of a genuine desire to just be in the presence of others. This is the first time I'm really feeling that in my life. And it's going to take me a while to build up any kind of durable social connections that can correspond to like a language that could make sense to me or anybody else. So I'd say I would give that one just like a TBD, like give me some time on that one.
Yeah. No, it's something we talk a lot about on the show, particularly when we talk about politics and culture, and something I spend a lot of time thinking and talking to people about is my thesis is that we have forgotten relatively quickly, but within the last 20, 30, 35 years, how to live in community.
Yes, and, exactly.
And we have to relearn, and I'm including myself within that. And, you know, as I said, I am someone involved of a restorationist Gnostic church, right? We've got a lot. We're doing it all from, not, I shouldn't say all, but we're doing it from scratch. Yeah. And I don't really have the answers either, both to how to build community, but also just as a participant, how to yes. properly live in community. I have exactly. some hints, I know, but I'm not completely there.
I will say this, though. I think that the second coming, I mean, if we pull this off, it will have been the second coming. Yes. It will be Jesus returning. I will say that. I 100% believe that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. The ancient Johannine Gnostics, they stopped waiting for the second coming because they believed that the community was the second coming. Jesus Absolutely. Had come, but not in the hearts of individuals.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Jesus was the community. That yeah. was the second coming.
Exactly.
Okay, we're getting here on time. The last thing I'll say is for this 21st century spirituality, which of course you've been dancing around because you don't know what it's going to look like. I don't know what it's going to look like, but I do really hope and really think it's coming. And again, sociologists of religion have a theory that religion really has an oomph. People go looking for answers after they have children or when someone close to them, like their parents, die, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, because of demographic shifts,
yeah,
people are not having children, or they're not having them as soon, and their parents are living a heck of a lot longer.
Yeah, right. Yeah. yeah.
So that might be part of the impetus, as well as I'm also fairly convinced, unfortunately, that the world is not getting better anytime soon. So yeah. hopefully this demographic shift and this very obviously Gnostic, demiurgic, black iron prison world does push people into whatever this 21st century spirituality is going to be.
Yes, I've said that before. It's like there's pressure on this structure that it cannot contain.
Okay, so final question, Matt. What's your favorite Gnostic influenced piece of art or media?
I would say Avatar.
Excellent answer. Yep. It's a great one, and yeah. the Gnostic themes are right up there, right up front. It's a great one for people in my community. We often we switched over from The Matrix to Avatar.
Yeah. It's the number one movie of all time. People are yeah. they want it. They know it. They don't know it why, but they don't know it. And that movie, the way that it was so beloved when people saw it, and then all of that, it all like went away culturally. People like to smugly point out that it doesn't have a cultural imprint. It's because you couldn't give it a marketable, memeable language because it was an emotion. Yeah. And you cannot turn that into culture because it's good and culture only reproduces evil.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Okay, Matt, before we go, do you have any plugs?
My Chapo colleague, Felix Biederman, and I are doing a show on Stitcher right now about the growth and evolution and development of prestige television dramas in America. We talk about the big ones like your Sopranos and your The Wire, but also just stuff like Lost. And we just kind of break them apart for like themes of empire in decline.
Yeah. Very excellent. Okay, everybody check that out at stitcher.com. Time for my stories. And of course, if you want to join Matt's cult, it's Kushbaum on twitter.com. I'm going to quickly do my plug. Sorry, Matt, before we hang up, which is... I teach secular meditation. I'm doing training to teach secular meditation that's open for all, sort of on top of the Gnostic stuff. Obviously, right now, I'm doing it outside of the house. I'm doing it for free every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We've got a good crowd of people. Even when I go back to doing it in person, I use a local yoga studio here in Montreal. I'm still going to be streaming those classes online. I give instruction. It's good for both beginners, and it's good for both those who have experience with meditation. It's about 45 minutes to an hour. Feel free to come in at any time. It's basically every Sunday, mylandmeditation.substack.com. I have a parish here in Montreal, the Holy Grail Parish. We meet every second Sunday. Yet again, we're normally in person. We're doing it online. It's mostly a meditation night. Feel free to come out and check it out. Again, we're not dogmatic. We're not going to require you to convert or believe a bunch of things. And as I said, it's pretty based upon meditation practice. Okay, well, that's it's been awesome having you, Matt. That was just an incredible show, and it was so much fun. So thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. It was great.